Chapter 4. The Emir of the Strangers. Jordan, the mid-1990s. The evidence against the accused was clear. For several months following his return from the jihad in Afghanistan, he had been an active member of a banned terrorist organization, Bayat al-Imam, or Allegiance to the Imam. In March 1994, a cache of grenades had been discovered hidden in the basement of the home he shared with his family. When police raided the building, he had tried to shoot the arresting officers, then himself. Both times, he had missed. Now, he was on trial for his crimes before Jordan's feared quasi-military state security court. A more rational man might have fallen on the court's mercy, pleaded for leniency. Instead, he submitted an absurd defense, claiming that he had found the grenades on the street. He refused even to recognize the legitimacy of the court or the government it represented. At one point during his trial, the accused handed the judge his own alternative indictment, implicating two defendants, King Hussein of Jordan, and the trial judge himself. "I was expected to inform the first defendant of the charges," the judge recalled 10 years later. Unsurprisingly, Zarqawi's obviously fabricated defense and mocking alternative indictment failed to impress the state security court. Its sentence was 15 years hard labor to be served in the desert prison of Al-Zawaqa. In the dozen years between his arrest in 1994 and his death in 2006, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi transformed himself into one of the most notorious terrorists in the world. As leader of what became Al-Qaeda in Iraq, he was responsible for the deaths of dozens of American soldiers and hundreds of Iraqi civilians. His organization carried out the videotaped beheadings of several Western hostages, with Zarqawi decapitating one of the victims himself. His men murdered, tortured, and brutalized the inhabitants of Iraqi towns under their control. And they precipitated a sectarian civil conflict in Iraq that would claim the lives of thousands, Sunni and Shia Muslims alike. For these crimes, courts in his native Jordan sentenced him to death in absentia no fewer than 4 times over. But perhaps Zarqawi's most consequential and destructive legacy is one with which we are still grappling today. He is responsible more than anyone else for Al-Qaeda in Iraq's mutation into the armed cult that calls itself the Islamic State. Before his conversion to radical Islam, Zarqawi had served time in prison for sexual assault and drug possession. In 2004, while he was quickly making a name for himself as Iraq's top terrorist, King Abdullah dismissively told the Italian daily newspaper Corriere della Sera, "As far as I know, he was some sort of a street thug in the town of Zarqa." Definitely, he was not known for his intellect or brilliance. Unexpectedly, he ended up in Al-Qaeda's network after his past as a common criminal and drunkard. Zarqawi has now become a problematic element in Iraq, where, in my opinion, he is given undeserved merit. Zarqawi, who died in June 2006 in a U.S. airstrike, was certainly a brutal and despicable man. But his journey from street thug to violent extremist is, in fact, not at all uncommon. Indeed, while ideology has a part to play in radicalizing and motivating terrorists, the opportunity to engage in criminal violence for its own sake appears to be just as significant a draw. A study by German intelligence found that around 2/3 of foreign fighters traveling from Germany to Syria had prior criminal records. Similarly, the backgrounds of the terrorists who attacked Paris in 2015 and Brussels in 2016 included convictions for theft, carjacking, assault, burglary, and drug dealing. Time spent as a criminal may actually enhance the resume of an aspiring jihadi. Extremist networks often bankroll their activities with drug smuggling, human trafficking, forgery, and other crimes. The Taliban funded their operations in part through opium trafficking. Zarqawi may have pioneered an especially brutal brand of terrorism. He may have risen to become leader of Iraq's foreign jihadis and, in effect, America's public enemy number one. But in terms of his background, he was not at all exceptional. Indeed, As the seemingly limitless flow of recruits to the Islamic State attests, Zarqawi and men like him seem to constitute an endlessly renewable resource. This should come as no surprise. Conditions in the Middle East are perfect for creating an abundance of angry young men acutely vulnerable to terrorist ideology. For decades, Arab governments have exhibited a cavalier disregard for education with catastrophic consequences. Arabs aged 25 and older have an average of just 6 years of schooling, roughly equivalent in American terms to having completed elementary school. According to a 2012 report by the Arab Thought Foundation, the average Western child spends around 200 hours per year reading, while his or her Arab counterpart spends 6 minutes. Adults do even worse. In the West, adults read an average of 11 books each year. In Arab countries, they read one quarter of one page. Almost 100 million Arabs cannot read or write at all. The Arab world displays relatively little intellectual openness to the wider world. Greece, with a population of 11 million, translates 5 times as many books annually as every Arab country put together. Even these statistics do not begin to tell the full story. Even at its highest levels, Arab education is a backward affair. Egypt, historically the center of Arab learning, is home to the region's leading universities, but its top graduate students are mostly learning how to memorize exactly what their professors tell them. Refuse to parrot back what you've been fed, and you are apt to fail. Think for yourself, critically weigh what you have been taught, express yourself originally, and you are sure to. Over the centuries, this perpetual drilling and memorization has forcibly stunted the imagination and hobbled the critical thinking of generation after generation. The result is a region not only ill-prepared for modernity, but also shockingly removed from it. The Arab world holds itself back in other ways. Women are systematically shut out of the workplace. Only about a third are employed. Many Arab countries have developed monoculture economies, built around oil or natural gas, that richly reward the few while denying a living wage to the many. Corruption is rampant. So is unemployment, particularly among the young. The striking absence of educational and economic opportunity, compounded by the lack of political accountability and a hopelessly distorted sense of history, has made Arab countries fertile soil for extremists. Even in Western countries, the neighborhoods that have churned out the most recruits for the Islamic State, such as Molenbeek in Brussels, look, from the point of view of a lower-class young man, like miniatures of the Arab world. Low employment, dim prospects, and a government apparently uninterested in addressing the root causes of these problems. King Abdullah was surely correct to grumble, as he did in his Corriere interview in 2004, that Zarqawi's status as a terrorist mastermind was exaggerated by the media. In fact, although His Majesty refrained from saying so, certain governments were equally culpable in talking up his importance. But to take the opposite course and dismiss him as a petty criminal is much too simplistic. Whatever else he may have been, Zarqawi was a prolific terrorist in his own right and a ruthless manipulator of public opinion. During his lifetime, his actions helped ignite a murderous conflict between Sunni and Shia at the center of the Arab heartland. Today, his angry ghost inhabits an armed group that, with its thousands of recruits, has conquered vast swaths of territory in Iraq and Syria. The record shows Zarqawi to have been more than a ruthless, emotionless brute. He apparently succeeded in memorizing the Quran and was deeply affected by the experience. He was also an avid student of the 12th century ruler Nur ad-Din Zangi, a Mesopotamian commander famous for his battles against European crusaders. Zarqawi perceived that he and Nur ad-Din lived in similar times. Then as now, power in the Middle East was splintered. The central government of the Abbasid caliphs was in decay. And local warlords like Nur ad-Din's own family, the rulers of Mosul in modern-day northern Iraq, were taking over. Meanwhile, powers from outside the region took advantage of the chaos to set up bases in Syria, Iraq, and Egypt. when crusaders assassinated his father, Nur ad-Din, strove to unite his fellow Muslims across Iraq and Syria against the Western invaders and drive them back into the sea, a dream that would eventually be realized a generation later by his Kurdish rival Saladin. In 1149, after defeating and capturing the crusader Prince of Antioch, Nur ad-Din had his enemy decapitated and the head sent as a trophy to the Caliph al-Muqtafi, nominally still Nur ad-Din's overlord. Then, in a grand gesture calculated to suggest the sweep of land he controlled, Nur ad-Din marched his army across the Syrian desert and symbolically bathed in the Mediterranean. Just as in Nur ad-Din's day, Arab civilization stands divided against itself, and the region is in palpable decline, spiritually, culturally, and economically. Once again, latent feelings of humiliation and rage spew forth like oil gushing from the desert floor. Then and now, Western invaders occupied areas of the Middle East, a new crusade in Zarqawi's mind. Ethnically, Nur ad-Din was not Arab, but Turkic, a characteristic he shares with many top Islamic State leaders. And if there is one event that sealed that group's murderous reputation, it was its 2014 capture of Nur ad-Din's old family seat, the city of Mosul. History repeats, Karl Marx wrote, first as tragedy, then as farce. The man who would become Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was born Ahmed Fadl Nazal al-Khalaya in the blue-collar town of Zarqa, a few miles northeast of the Jordanian capital Amman, in October 1966. He was raised in Al-Masum, a poor neighborhood that blends into the outskirts of the Al-Rusayfa Palestinian refugee camp, where Zarqawi was to become attuned to radical ideas for the first time. Ethnically, however, Zarqawi was not a Palestinian like millions of his countrymen, but a member of the Bani Hassan tribe of Bedouin. This cultural identity gave him a special place in the esteem of some Jordanians, an advantage that he would later use to full effect. Since at least the 1960s, Zarqa had been the epicenter in Jordan of the intensely puritanical Salafi school of Islam, and in particular, an even more virulent substrain known as the Salafi Jihadi movement, a violent and intolerant creed to which both Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State adhere. Hundreds of young men from Zarqa and its twin town of Rusayfa fought in Afghanistan in the 1980s, Chechnya in the 1990s, and Iraq in the 2000s. To this day, Zarqa still seethes with extremism and discontent. Even Jordanian intelligence officers, who rank among the boldest and most effective such operatives in the world, are fearful of the area. In September of 1970, when Zarqawi was 3 years old, the leader of the Palestine Liberation Organization, Yasser Arafat, called for the overthrow of what he called the fascist government of King Hussein of Jordan. Thousands of disenfranchised Palestinians living in Jordan joined an armed uprising called Black September. Jordanian security services routed the insurgents. In towns like Zarqa, the unrest sent yet more young people into the arms of radical fundamentalists. And it had another damaging effect, this one longer term. As a quid pro quo for its cooperation in putting down the revolt, King Hussein handed control of Jordan's education ministry over to the Muslim Brotherhood, which promotes adherence to dogma above intellectual curiosity. When Zarqawi was 17 years old, his father died. He was forced to drop out of high school a year early to help his mother take care of the household. But the young man's slide into depravity had already begun. 2 years earlier, when he was just 15, he had reportedly participated in a robbery at the home of a relative, in the course of which the relative had been killed. Now in his late teens and early 20s, he became a full-blown dropout. For a time, he worked in a video store, but he was soon fired. He began getting tattoos, eventually covering so much of his body that he acquired the nickname the Green Man. He drank heavily, took drugs, became involved in gang crime, and perhaps pimping. Within a few years, he was serving his first jail time for sexual assault and drug possession. Following his release under the terms of one of Jordan's periodic royal amnesties, Zarqawi began attending radical lectures and sermons in Zarqaa and at the neighboring Rusayfa Palestinian refugee camp. He would later say that he returned to Islam around September of 1989 at the minute and modest Al-Falah Mosque in his home neighborhood of Al-Masum. 3 months later, at the age of 23, he was on a plane to Afghanistan. Zarqawi's trip, like those of many others, was facilitated by the Jordanian cleric Abu Qatada, later notorious for his extremist preaching at London's Finsbury Park Mosque, and financed by the Office of Mujahideen Services, a group set up by Osama bin Laden's mentor, Abdullah Azam. By the time Zarqawi arrived in Afghanistan, bin Laden had already slunk off to Saudi Arabia in disgrace following the disastrous Mujahideen attack on Jalalabad. The Soviets and the CIA had pulled out, leaving behind a conflict grotesquely morphing from a freedom struggle against an aggressive outside power into a vicious intertribal war. Zarqawi trained under Al-Qaeda's military chief, Abu Hafs al-Masri, and gave himself the nom de guerre Al-Gharib, or the Stranger. Abdullah Azam's son, who knew Zarqawi during this first tour in Afghanistan, remembered a man of few words, an ordinary guy, but one who did not know the meaning of fear, and who intentionally placed himself in the middle of the most dangerous situations. Over the course of a number of battles, Zarqawi witnessed the colossal Muslim-on-Muslim violence that characterized this new and horrifying phase of the Afghan conflict. When not fighting, he worked as a correspondent for the jihadist magazine Al-Bunyan Al-Marsus, the Solid Edifice, which also counted among its alumni Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the architect of 9/11, and Wadi al-Hajj, one of the principal co-conspirators in the 1998 embassy bombings. When Zarqawi returned to Jordan in the early 1990s, it was to a country even more vexed by extremism than it had been when he had left. King Hussein, having given up Jordan's territorial claim to the West Bank in the late 1980s, was making further peace overtures to Israel, a move that had Jordanian radicals seething with anger. In the aftermath of the 1990-1991 Gulf War, Kuwait had expelled its Palestinian population en masse, perceiving them as supporters of Saddam Hussein. Many of the refugees had come to Jordan, and around 160,000 of them had settled in Zarqaa. Among them was one of the most influential scholars in the Salafi jihadi movement, the cleric Abu Muhammad al-Muqtazi. Zarqawi had first encountered Muqtazi in Peshawar, a way station for those bound for the fighting in Afghanistan. In short order, the young Zarqawi, still in his mid-twenties, fell under the spell of Muqtazi's fiery teachings. Muqtazi had been born in the West Bank, at the time under Jordanian control, but while he was still a child, his family had emigrated to Kuwait. There, in neighboring Saudi Arabia, he came into contact with scholars promoting the radical jihadi form of Salafism. Muqtazi had risen to become one of the principal exponents of the fundamentalist Salafi jihadi movement, revered by his followers as a charismatic preacher and a brilliant scholar and writer. In the mid-1980s, he wrote in his first and most influential book, The Creed of Abraham, that anyone who even so much as obeyed laws made by secular rulers, as opposed to the Sharia made by God, was practicing a form of polytheism and was therefore not a real Muslim. In Muqtazi's view, apostates, those who turned away from the true faith, were far worse than infidels, those who were never Muslim in the first place. Therefore, Muqtazi reasons, the more important jihad was not the one against the far enemy, the Americans whom Muqtazi saw as mere infidels, but the one targeting the near enemy, secular regimes of the Muslim world itself, which he painted as apostates. This was the diametric opposite of the worldview that Osama bin Laden would come to espouse a decade later in his declaration of war against America. In the fevered atmosphere of early 1990s Jordan, extremist groups began popping up all over the country, especially in historically rebellious Zarqaa. One of these groups, Bayat al-Imam, coalesced around Muqtazi in around 1993. Zarqawi joined Bayat al-Imam soon after its formation and lost no time in reaching out to Jordanian militants with experience of fighting in the ongoing civil wars in Afghanistan, Yugoslavia, or elsewhere. In keeping with Muqtasi's sermons, Zarqawi's pitch to these men revolved around overthrowing the near enemy, starting with Jordan's own Hashemite monarchy. But Bayat al-Imam's first terrorist operation was a shambles. The group sent an operative to blow up a local movie theater in Zarqa, but the man assigned to the job, apparently unable to wrench his eyes away from the screen, forgot about his mission, stayed too long in the theater, and wound up blowing his own legs off. Soon Zarqawi and Muqtasi found themselves imprisoned together. At first, they operated in partnership. Muqtasi preached his religious justifications for jihad and wrote books and articles on fundamentalist theology, which he published online. Meanwhile, Zarqawi governed his fellow inmates with an iron fist. One of them later recalled, "Zarqawi was the muscle and Muqtasi the thinker. Zarqawi basically controlled the prison ward. He decided who would cook, who would do the laundry, who would lead the readings of the Quran. He was extremely protective of his followers and extremely tough with prisoners outside his group. He didn't trust them. He considered them infidels. He could order his followers to do things just by moving his eyes." Zarqawi exercised rigorous control over his followers, down to their attire, facial hair, reading material, and contact with inmates outside the group. He waged open warfare against the prison's other gangs and became known for his violent attacks on guards and inmates alike. On one occasion, he was placed in solitary confinement for participating in a brawl, and when he returned to the main ward, his followers spontaneously broke into a triumphant chant of "Allahu Akbar." It was not long before Zarqawi had pushed aside his former mentor to assume sole command of Bayat al-Imam, with Muqtasi demoted to the status of a mere advisor. "Jail was very good for the movement," one member said. "Jail enhanced the personalities of prisoners and let them know how large was the cause they believed in. Inside jail is a good environment to get supporters and proselytize." It was not the first time prison would galvanize a jihadi movement, and nor would it be the last. In the 1980s, imprisonment in Mubarak's Egypt strengthened the resolve of terrorist leaders like Ayman al-Zawahiri. 20 years later, in Iraq, American prisons like Camp Buka would bring jihadis into contact with former servants of the Saddam regime, thereby helping to revivify the organization that would become the Islamic State. Jail was very good for Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, too. His network of criminal and extremist contacts grew wider and stronger than ever. At the same time, his presence became ever more commanding. A jihadi who knew him both before and after said, "When I heard Zarqawi speak, I didn't believe this is the same Zarqawi." Behind bars, he had acquired the swagger for which he was to become notorious during his brief murderous career in Iraq. He was still prepared to use dogma as a tool of persuasion, but whatever patience he once had for religious argument had now evaporated. Doctrinal disputes of the kind that bin Laden and Muqtasi were apt to enter into, discussions about the near enemy and the far enemy, the permissibility of spilling Muslim blood, whether and when to declare an enemy an unbeliever, meant little to him now, as far as Zarqawi was concerned. His enemy was anyone who failed to live by his own backward concept of Islam and morality, a category that includes almost all Muslims, as well as almost all of humankind. Zarqawi's world was full of foes, and he was interested in fighting as many of them as he could lay blows upon as quickly as possible. On February 7, 1999, King Hussein died, and his 37-year-old son ascended the throne as Abdullah II. To commemorate the occasion, as was traditional, the new monarch declared a general amnesty. Once again, Zarqawi was released from prison, ironically, given his avowed aim of overthrowing the Hashemite monarchy. In Amman, he involved himself in directing the preparations for the failed Millennium Bomb plots, for which the Jordanian authorities would later indict him. but he was hungry for jihad on a grander scale. In the company of some of his closest Jordanian companions, he made his way once more to the extremist entrepot of Peshawar. His mother was by now gravely ill with leukemia, and he brought her with him in hopes that the climate might help her condition. Zarqawi was in the process of arranging to travel to Chechnya, then the world's hottest theater of jihad, when he was abruptly informed that he was about to be thrown out of Pakistan for visa irregularities. Hurriedly, he and his companions made their way across the border to Afghanistan. In his pocket was a letter of introduction from a respected Jordanian jihadi who had won fame fighting the Soviets in the 1980s. Apparently, this was enough to secure Zarqawi an audience with the Sheikh. In December 1999, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and Osama bin Laden met face-to-face for the first and quite probably only time at a Taliban guest house in Kandahar. Bin Laden, as always, would have sat cross-legged on the floor of a drab, sparsely decorated room, dressed in his usual plain shalwar kameez. The Sheikh would have spoken softly and would have expected the young Jordanian to show the same hushed reverence almost every visitor afforded him. But Zarqawi, still skinny in those days and perennially full of nervous energy, would have found difficulty sitting still or keeping his voice down, something that was sure to antagonize the Sheikh. The meeting did not go well. As an Israeli intelligence official would later say, it was a case of loathing at first sight. Bin Laden was already predisposed to be suspicious of Jordanian operatives, having learned through bitter experience how comprehensively Jordanian intelligence had infiltrated their networks. The Al-Qaeda leader, soft-spoken, reserved, and used to being treated with the utmost respect, bridled at the younger man's braggadocio. And Zarqawi did not hold back. He lambasted Al-Qaeda's Taliban hosts for what he branded their insufficient zeal in applying Sharia, and for recognizing the United Nations, which Zarqawi saw as a council of infidels. He even had the gall to criticize bin Laden himself for associating with the Taliban, and for failing to denounce other supposedly insufficiently Islamic regimes. Needless to say, Zarqawi would not be pledging bayat to Osama bin Laden anytime soon. He also made a show of his own deep hatred of those Muslims who did not conform to his own ideas of the faith, starting with the other main sect of Islam. Shiites should be executed, Zarqawi declared, a death sentence that would have included the families of the Sheikh's own mother and first wife. At the same time, Zarqawi said he would not fight the Northern Alliance because that would involve real Muslims killing their fellow believers. In the midst of his tirade, Zarqawi demanded Al-Qaeda's support in developing a terror network with the aim of overthrowing the Jordanian monarchy. Given how deeply his words alienated the Sheikh, this was like Jefferson asking George III to finance the construction of Monticello. Unsurprisingly, bin Laden initially demurred. But after lengthy discussions, Saif al-Adl persuaded bin Laden that assisting Zarqawi and his group would be in Al-Qaeda's best interests. This was partly because Al-Qaeda felt the need for a foothold in the Levant, but it was also to thwart an independent jihadi, Abu Musab al-Suri, who had recently set up camp in Afghanistan. Al-Suri was siphoning off Levantine recruits who otherwise might have joined Al-Qaeda. Ironically, Zarqawi's group, having morphed into the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, ISIL, would eventually turn on Al-Qaeda, whereas followers of Al-Suri would go on to form Al-Qaeda's own loyal franchise in Syria, a group called Al-Nusra. As a result of Saif's intervention, Zarqawi and his companions were sent for 45 days training at one of Al-Qaeda's camps near Kandahar. Then, with real estate and seed capital provided by Al-Qaeda, Zarqawi established his own camp at Herat in Afghanistan's far west. The location was chosen in part to keep his group at arm's length in case of infiltration by Jordanian intelligence. This suited Zarqawi too. From his point of view, the distance from Kandahar served to emphasize the ideological gap between himself and Al-Qaeda and to attract some of the many Arab jihadists who preferred not to fight under bin Laden's banner. Herat's proximity to the Iranian border, moreover, helped facilitate the smuggling of recruits into Afghanistan through Turkey and Iran. This was not only a more convenient pipeline for recruits from the Levant and Mesopotamia, it also freed Zarqawi from reliance on the Al-Qaeda fixers in Peshawar. To reflect his territorial ambitions, Zarqawi initially called this new group Jund al-Sham, Soldiers of the Levant. As a Jordanian official would put it shortly before Zarqawi's death, Herat was the beginning of what he is now. He had command responsibilities for the first time. He had a battle plan. And even though he and bin Laden never got on, he was important to them. Herat was the only training camp in Afghanistan that was actively recruiting volunteers specifically from the Sham, Levant. In Herat, he called himself Emir of the Sham. The Al-Qaeda High Command furnished the camp with supplies and held monthly meetings to keep tabs on Zarqawi and his followers, whose numbers quickly mushroomed until he had dozens of men under his command. Many of the major operatives at the camp were Syrians, some of whom would later show their faces on the battlefields of Syria and Iraq. Many jihadis even brought their families to live with them at the camp, leading Zarqawi to boast that he presided over an ideal Islamic society in miniature. During his time at Herat, he married again, taking his second wife, the 14-year-old daughter of one of his Palestinian followers. Zarqawi doggedly maintained the autonomy of his group, which he soon renamed Tawhid wal Jihad, monotheism and jihad. Despite repeated overtures, he declined to pledge Bayat to Al-Qaeda, or indeed to any of the other Arab groups operating in Afghanistan. He stubbornly refused to march under the banner of another individual or group, as a fellow Islamist would later put it. At the same time, he was stretching his tentacles further and further from Afghanistan. He dispatched emissaries as far afield as Turkey and Germany to seek cash and recruits. His fundraising efforts in Europe even competed with those of Al-Qaeda. Naturally, Al-Qaeda did not make Zarqawi, a non-member with whom it had, to say the least, a fraught relationship, privy to its plans. The attacks on New York and Washington in September of 2001 therefore came as a complete surprise to him and his group. But they would have tremendous consequences for them nonetheless. In their immediate aftermath, his miniature society at Herat would be shattered. But the extended American response to 9/11 would ultimately bring Zarqawi's terrorist career to its apotheosis. When the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan began, Zarqawi was in Kandahar, consulting with the powers that be in Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Upon hearing news of the invasion, he raced back to Herat to command his followers. Under intense ground and aerial assault, Herat's Taliban defenders quickly folded, and the Northern Alliance took the city on November 12th. Zarqawi and Tawhid wal Jihad fled Herat in a long convoy, bound for Kandahar. There, they took part in the defense of the city under the command of Saif al-Adl. In the course of one bombardment, Zarqawi reportedly suffered broken ribs when a ceiling collapsed on him, but he refused to leave the fighting. In the end, however, he was forced to bow to the inevitable. Along with the other Taliban and Arab-Afghan leaders, he fled Kandahar and Afghanistan. Long after the fact, Zarqawi's propaganda would claim that his intention in leaving Afghanistan was not to flee, but to open several new battlefronts with the Americans, to disperse their forces and deny them the chance to focus on one region. Around the close of 2001, Zarqawi crossed into Iran with a group of perhaps 300 fighters. Some followers of the Afghan warlord Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, a former CIA protege who had taken refuge in Tehran following the Taliban victory in 1996, helped Zarqawi and his group establish a presence in Iran. But this sojourn in the lands of the Ayatollahs would prove limited in duration, partly because, as a side effect of the conflict in Afghanistan, Iranian and American objectives in the region had suddenly come into alignment. It was in the best interests of both powers to tackle Sunni extremism and weaken any potential allies of the Taliban. In furtherance of this policy, Iran started to crack down on the many Arab militants who had taken up refuge on its soil. As much as 80% of Tawhid wal Jihad was caught up in the ensuing purges. Iran was not the only government taking a hard line with such groups. In February and April of 2002, around a dozen Tawhid wal Jihad members were detained in Turkey and Germany. They made Zarqawi's presence in Iran known to the authorities, and within weeks of the second set of arrests, Zarqawi was forced to relocate over the border to northern Iraq. Once again, his propaganda arm would later paint this move in a much more flattering light, claiming that his departure was the result of a premeditated and far-sighted decision made in order to prepare for confrontations to face the U.S. invasion and defeat the Americans. In April 2002, he took refuge with Ansar al-Islam, one of the Kurdish Islamist groups camped out in the mountains of Iraqi Kurdistan. There is evidence that Saddam Hussein's intelligence operation was on some level coordinating with Ansar al-Islam and similar groups in the region. There was no love lost between Islamist militants and secular Ba'athists, but both sides expected war with the United States and recognized their mutual interest in fighting the Americans. Besides, Saddam's government already had a long history of sponsoring global terrorists. To many such groups, the regime offered not only safe haven, but also weapons, training, and logistical assistance. The beneficiaries of Iraqi hospitality included armed groups that aimed to attack Iran, Israel, and the United States. While sheltering in Iraq, Palestinian and leftist terrorist groups carried out bombings, assassinations, and hijackings, including that of the Achille Lauro cruise ship, in which an elderly disabled American passenger was murdered and his body dumped overboard. Around the same time as the 1990-91 Gulf War, the Iraqi regime itself attempted several terrorist attacks, using its own intelligence operatives and various Palestinian factions, although each of these efforts ended in failure. Later, during the Second Palestinian Intifada of 2000-2005, Saddam used the Arab Liberation Front, his own personal pawn in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, to offer $25,000 to the family of each Palestinian killed in an Israeli attack. Like other Islamist groups, al-Qaeda was certainly no friend to secular Muslim rulers like Saddam. In 1990, bin Laden had even offered to help eject the regime's armed forces from Kuwait. On the other hand, once the Gulf War was over, Saddam and al-Qaeda had a common enemy in the shape of the United States, and both sides had shown themselves pragmatic enough to make deals with their natural adversaries. During the 1990s, according to the CIA, Saddam's intelligence service had made contact with al-Qaeda on a number of occasions, both in Sudan and in Afghanistan, although these links did not add up to an established formal relationship. In the course of their discussions, there had been some mention of safe haven in Iraq for bin Laden, although it is by no means clear that such protection was ever actually offered. By the beginning of the Iraq War, between 100 and 200 al-Qaeda members and associates had moved into Iraqi Kurdistan, anticipating an opportunity to take on America on Muslim soil. Like Zarqawi, these fighters were hosted by Ansar al-Islam, a group founded in December 2001 as the product of a merger between several Kurdish Sunni extremist groups. From its inception, Ansar al-Islam had enjoyed strong links with al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda helped to train at least one of its predecessor groups, and its charter members may have included a contingent of al-Qaeda operatives fresh from the fighting in Afghanistan. However, the Iraqi group's own main focus was, at least in the beginning, more localized. It aimed to battle its more secular Kurdish rivals, with the goal of eventually turning the Kurdistan region into an independent Islamic emirate. Zarqawi himself was, of course, not a member of al-Qaeda, at least not yet. Almost from the moment of his arrival in Iraq, he set about building his own independent web of militant cells, putting in place the network he would need to exploit the chaos to come. Jihadis entering Iraq were inspired in part by a dubious hadith, allegedly prophesying an apocalyptic battle for Mesopotamia. Zarqawi helped construct an infrastructure to smuggle recruits into the country through Syria. This pipeline soon included recruitment centers where would-be fighters could sign up at a registration desk in the morning and cross into Iraq by bus a few hours later. The Assad regime not only allowed this to take place, it happily assisted Zarqawi and his peers. Syrian officials ferried jihadists from Damascus International Airport to the Iraqi border. With an invasion of its neighbor clearly in the cards, the regime feared that it might be next on America's list. When it came to Iraq, therefore, Assad calculated that his best chance of survival lay not in cooperating with the United States, but in ejecting American troops from Syria's backyard before it was too late. In March 2003, days before the U.S. aerial assault on Baghdad began, Assad told his close ally, Ayatollah Khamenei, "If we cannot defeat the Americans, then we need to ensure the situation remains volatile and suicide operations carry on unabated." Assad would make sure that the insurgent pipeline through Damascus remained open throughout the Iraq War. In 2009, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, though closely aligned with Assad's most important patron, Iran, complained that 90% of the foreign terrorists in Iraq had entered the country by crossing the Syrian border. Syria also harbored exiled Iraqi Ba'athists, whom Assad's intelligence services helped plan several deadly attacks, including one of the war's bloodiest, a truck bombing at the finance ministry in 2009 that killed over 100 people, in response to which the Maliki regime recalled its ambassador from Damascus. Using the Syrian pipeline, Zarqawi built up a network of perhaps hundreds of foreign fighters. Naturally enough, many of them, particularly in these early days, were Syrians, who likely wanted to escape the prying eyes of the Assad regime. On one occasion, 36 Syrians pledged bayat to Zarqawi en masse. It was a group that included, among others, Abu Muhammad al-Udnani, who would eventually become the principal spokesman for the Islamic State. Soon, Zarqawi would be importing Libyans, Moroccans, Algerians, Yemenis, Tunisians, and a particularly sizable contingent of Saudis. Zarqawi's Syrian pipeline became so efficient that by the start of the invasion, Saif al-Adl was asking if he could use it to bring al-Qaeda operatives into Iraq. Zarqawi traveled the country and the region, distributing his terror cells around Baghdad, Fallujah, and Iraq's other cities. By the beginning of 2003, he was almost ready to begin operations. Yet despite his high profile among foreign fighters traveling to Iraq, he and his group were still practically unknown to the American public. That was set to change dramatically. On February 5, 2003, U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell, who had been the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time of the Gulf War, took his seat at the vast circular table of the United Nations Security Council to deliver a presentation meant to make the case for renewed military action against Iraq. The main focus of the speech was the Saddam regime's alleged pursuit or possession of chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. But toward the end of his hour-long address, he included a passage meant to substantiate a link between Saddam and al-Qaeda. In terms of U.S. public opinion, this was an important part of the argument for war. It suggested that Saddam might put his doomsday weapons into the hands of terrorists. It also tacitly hinted at a connection, however obscure, between his regime and 9/11. The attacks had taken place less than 18 months before. Powell described a sinister nexus between Iraq and the al-Qaeda terrorist network. And at that nexus, according to the Bush administration, was Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. The Secretary of State painted Zarqawi's Herat camp, as well as certain facilities of Ansar al-Islam, Zarqawi's one-time hosts in Kurdistan, as virtual poison factories, specializing in the manufacture of ricin, a toxin that can be lethal even in comparatively minute doses. Powell claimed that an Iraqi agent embedded in Ansar al-Islam had invited Zarqawi into northern Iraq in 2002 and said that the agent had said that Zarqawi was planning attacks in Europe and Russia. The picture of Zarqawi as the crucial link between Saddam and bin Laden was at best something of a stretch, not least because Zarqawi was still fiercely independent of al-Qaeda. But the impression of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi as the premier foreign terrorist in Iraq had now become indelible. It was an image that would serve him well. With terrible irony, much of the erroneous information in Powell's speech was extracted using methods of the kind that would in time prove an even more potent recruiting sergeant for terrorism than the war itself. Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi, once head of the Khaldan camp in Afghanistan through which so many jihadis passed on their way to a terrorist career, was arrested in Afghanistan, removed from FBI custody before his interrogation could be completed, rendered to a third country, and repeatedly tortured at the behest of the CIA. Hoping to stop the torture and avoid transfer to an even less sympathetic intelligence service, al-Libi told his captors just what they wanted to hear, that Saddam Hussein had trained al-Qaeda in the use of chemical and biological weapons. This was the lie that helped open the door for an invasion of Iraq. But torture's trail of destruction did not end with faulty intelligence. Harsh treatment of detainees in U.S. custody, particularly when documented on film, fed directly into the terrorists' own lie that the United States was waging war against Islam and would stop at nothing in its determination to humiliate Muslims. As the former general counsel of the U.S. Navy, Alberto Mora, would tell the Senate Armed Services Committee in June 2008, there are serving U.S. flag rank officers, that is, those ranked rear admiral and above, who maintain that the first and second identifiable causes of U.S. combat deaths in Iraq, as judged by their effectiveness in recruiting insurgent fighters into combat, are respectively the symbols of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. Nor did the power of these symbols dissipate when the United States left Iraq. Years later, militant hostage takers still dress their Western captives in orange jumpsuits, in symbolic revenge for the Guantanamo Bay detainees. And images from Abu Ghraib still help radicalize young men around the world, including the French-born terrorists who murdered a dozen people at the offices of Charlie Hebdo in January 2015. In private, Powell expressed reservations about the administration's case for war, but he was led to believe that the intelligence was accurate, and his presentation made clear the Bush White House's determination to use force in Iraq, with or without a Security Council resolution explicitly authorizing an invasion. About a week after the speech, with the war drums beating louder and louder, bin Laden himself released an audio message addressed to our Muslim brothers in Iraq, in which he emphasized the need for unity in the face of what he called a crusade. The forthcoming battle, he said, should be for the sake of the one God. It should not be for championing ethnic groups. In such circumstances, he said, it was permissible to make common cause with elements of the Saddam regime. Tactically, he recommended guerrilla warfare and martyrdom operations, suicide bombings. In due time, he even envisaged the exporting of the conflict to neighboring states. Zarqawi would eventually deliver on all of these agenda items, with one glaring exception. Far from unifying Muslims, he would seek to tear the Islamic community apart with unprecedented ferocity. Even by the nihilistic standards of contemporary jihadi terrorism, Zarqawi's methods were especially vicious. His statements of this period make for chilling reading. In one audio message, he sanctioned the indiscriminate murder of innocents. There is no doubt that God has commanded us to target the unbelievers and to kill them and fight them with every means that can accomplish this goal. even if the means does not distinguish between the intended warring unbelievers and unintended women and children, as well as those among the unbelievers whose intentional killing is not permitted. In another message, he countenanced the killing even of real Muslims if that was necessary to keep his jihad going. The shedding of Muslim blood is allowed, he said, in order to avoid the greater evil of disrupting jihad. Islamic law states that the Islamic faith is more important than life, honor, and property. We cannot kill infidels without killing some Muslims. Perhaps most disturbingly of all, Zarqawi told Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, simply, blood will be spilled. This is exactly what we want, since right and wrong no longer have any place in our current situation. His years away from Jordan had done nothing to blunt his hatred for the government of his home country. In the summer of 2002, months before the U.S. invasion began, he set up a base in Syria to train operatives for attacks on Jews and Americans inside Jordan. Quietly, he set up at least one cell in Amman and provided it with weapons, finance, and direction. In late October 2002, his operatives struck for the first time. They ambushed Lawrence Foley, a senior diplomat with the U.S. Agency for International Development, as he got into his car on his way to work, and shot him dead. Two of the murderers, a Jordanian and a Libyan, were captured and confessed that Zarqawi had sent them. This was the first of the four crimes for which Jordan would sentence Zarqawi to death in absentia. Around a year later, he was planning another strike in Amman, this time a mass casualty attack, possibly involving chemical weapons. The plot was foiled by the Jordanian security services. Undeterred by the unraveling of his plan, Zarqawi threatened further attacks against the Hashemite kingdom, saying in a statement, "War has ups and downs, and as the days go by, we will have more fierce confrontations with the Jordanian government. The chapters of some of these confrontations have ended, but what is coming is more vicious and bitter, God willing." In the summer of 2003, when his campaign of murder inside Iraq began in earnest, Zarqawi's first major target was again Jordanian. On August 7th, a vehicle exploded outside the Jordanian embassy in Baghdad. Just as dozens of locals were lining up outside, waiting to have their visas processed, there were reports of a rocket having been fired at the vehicle to ignite the explosives inside. The force of the blast propelled a car that had been parked outside the building onto a neighboring rooftop. 17 people died, all of them Iraqis. Less than 2 weeks later, a 26-year-old Moroccan, a young father who just that morning had been told that the baby his wife was carrying was a boy, crashed a cement mixer full of explosives through the wall around the United Nations compound in Baghdad. It exploded as a press conference about landmine removal efforts was underway and struck the building just under the office of the Secretary General's special representative in Iraq, Sergio Vieira de Mello, who was killed along with 16 others. The young bomber could be identified only by his severed feet and hands, which the authorities found 150 yards from the scene of the explosion. Apart from the loss of life, the bombing also had another tragic consequence: the withdrawal of the United Nations and other international agencies from Iraq, just when they were most sorely needed to aid efforts toward reconstruction and reconciliation. From the start of U.S. operations, Zarqawi's operatives rained rocket fire on American forces. But overall, more than three-quarters of his targets were Iraqi. And the so-called enemies for whom Zarqawi reserved his most venomous hatred were Shia Muslims. Zarqawi's black animus toward the Shia ran deep. He called them rejectionists, the enemy, and liars, and accused them of harboring hidden rancor toward the Sunnis. He blamed them for the Mongol conquest of Iraq in the 13th century and for sabotaging the Ottoman attempt to take over Western Europe 300 years later. He professed to believe that Shia Muslims were the servants of the Antichrist. lost in his own black-and-white sectarian moral universe, Zarqawi rejected calls for all Muslims to unite against the Americans. In fact, he viewed the divide between Sunnis and Shia in much starker terms than that between Sunnis and Americans. As he asked rhetorically, "Why is it permissible to strike the enemy when he has blonde hair and blue eyes, but it is not permissible to strike him when he has dark hair and black eyes? A Muslim American is our dear brother. An infidel Arab is our hated enemy, even if we both come from the same womb. We have revived the jurisprudence of our good ancestors in fighting heretics and enforcing God's law on them. Jihad will be continuous and will not distinguish between Western infidels and heretic Arabs until the rule of the caliphate is restored or we die in the process." Mesopotamia has always been one of the stages on which Islam's great schism has played out. Two of the most revered figures in Shia Islam, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, the fourth caliph, and his son, Imam Hussein, were each killed, martyred, according to Shia tradition, within about 100 miles of Baghdad. The Imam Ali Mosque in Najaf is built around a shrine Shias believe houses Ali's tomb. It is the third holiest site in Shia Islam, after Mecca and Medina. There, on Friday, August 29, 2003, just as prayers were breaking up, a suicide car bomb struck the departing motorcade of Ayatollah Muhammad Bakr al-Hakim, engulfing several vehicles in a ball of flame. Ayatollah Hakim was killed, together with more than 100 other worshippers. The suicide bomber, whose device caused the carnage, was Zarqawi's own father-in-law. His daughter was the Palestinian teenager Zarqawi had married back in Herat. It was the bloodiest attack of the Iraq War so far, although its death toll would soon be surpassed. The pattern of attacks on international and Shia targets continued for the rest of 2003 and into 2004. In March, Zarqawi's group helped stage multiple coordinated attacks on Shia sites in Karbala, sacred to Shia Muslims as the place where Hussein, the son of the fourth caliph Ali, was beheaded, on Ashura, the day of mourning for Hussein's death. In those attacks and simultaneous atrocities in Baghdad, around 180 worshippers and bystanders were killed. Zarqawi and his followers still did not control any appreciable territory from which to launch attacks, however, and this boded ill for their avowed aim of re-establishing the caliphate, a vast empire that once stretched from Pakistan to the Pyrenees. One senior Zarqawi lieutenant wrote a report lamenting this state of affairs. "After 1 year of jihad, we have not accomplished anything on the ground. None of us could find a piece of land to use as a shelter or a place to retire to safety amongst some members of our group. We would hide in daylight and sneak like a cat at night. Homes were raided and the heroes were chased. It was a dark picture, and everyone felt a sense of terrible failure." The insurgency needed a base, a safe haven, a beachhead they could control. One of the clearest candidates was Fallujah, an ancient city on the east bank of the Euphrates, around 40 miles east of Baghdad, and known locally as the City of Mosques for its many sacred buildings. Located inside the area west and northwest of Baghdad, known as the Sunni Triangle, Fallujah had been a bastion of support for the Sunni regime of Saddam Hussein. Beginning just after the U.S. invasion, American forces had helped foment unrest in the city with their heavy-handed tactics. In April 2003, American soldiers opened fire on peaceful protesters, killing 17 civilians. Insurgents retaliated for this and similar incidents by murdering 4 Blackwater security contractors and publicly displaying their blackened corpses hung from a bridge on the city's western approaches. Al-Qaeda and its allies saw an opportunity to turn Fallujah into a focal point of resistance against the occupation and a secure beachhead for the insurgency, and fought the Americans hard for control of the city. By the beginning of May 2004, the U.S. had withdrawn, leaving Fallujah in the hands of Al-Qaeda. The militants were to hold the city for more than half a year. The next month, June 2004, Zarqawi reportedly presided over a ceremony in Fallujah in which some of the local insurgent leaders pledged bayat to him. His foreign fighters set about turning Fallujah into what his deputies called the Republic of al-Zarqawi. In so doing, they transformed the city of mosques into a vision of hell comparable in its ferocity to the nightmare the Taliban had made of Kabul 8 years before. According to local residents, men who failed to grow beards were publicly whipped. As was anyone suspected of drinking alcohol, women wearing makeup or displaying their hair were publicly humiliated. Suspected spies could be summarily shot. It was a pattern of repression that would repeat itself years later in the areas of Iraq and Syria controlled by the Islamic State. Fallujah anticipated the Islamic State in other ways as well. Prominent among the foreign fighters ruling the city was a contingent of Tunisians, many of them from the small city of Ben Gourdan on the Libyan border. Zarqawi was so impressed with these militants that he reportedly said, "If Ben Gourdan had been located next to Fallujah, we would have liberated Iraq." Tunisians would later become the largest foreign contingent fighting in Syria, more than 1,000 of them from Ben Gourdan alone. Fallujah's traumatized residents might have turned Zarqawi and his crew out of their city had Zarqawi not enjoyed the support of a respected and feared local fundamentalist, Omar Hadid. A decade earlier, Hadid had tried to impose Puritanism on his hometown using violence by intimidating business owners, bombing the city's only movie theater, and assassinating a Ba'ath Party official. It was Hadid who had led the anti-American insurgency in Fallujah months before Zarqawi decided to make the city a hub for his own operation. Now, Hadid pledged fealty to the Jordanian. Although he claims to have participated only in fighting the Americans, not in bombings or beheadings of civilians, which he says he left to the foreigners. During his reign of terror in Fallujah, Zarqawi began to articulate more forcefully his plan to export his Stygian vision to the rest of Iraq and the region. Toward the start of the occupation, he stated that he saw his role in Iraq as waging jihad with my brothers to establish for Islam a homeland and for the Quran a state. And as the occupation of Fallujah wore on, he came increasingly to see that outcome as a genuine possibility. Around this time, too, Zarqawi began stepping up his campaign against the United States and its allies in the new government of Iraq. His group was blamed for the assassination, on May 17, 2004, of the Shia president of the Iraqi Governing Council, killed by a suicide car bomb. In June, Zarqawi's fighters blew up a Western convoy, killing 13 people, including three employees of General Electric. In mid-September, they attacked a market in West Baghdad, killing at least 47 people. At the end of the month, a bombing at the inauguration of a new water treatment facility took the lives of 35 children who were running to accept sweets being handed out by American troops. A second blast was timed to kill rescuers trying to help those injured in the first explosion. Characteristically, a statement from Tawhid wal-Jihad lauded these callous acts of mass murder as heroic operations.